Welcome. I'm Rachel Greenberg, and this is Volta Insider. Today, I welcome Kevin Cirilli, chief Washington correspondent for Bloomberg News and Bloomberg Television. Kevin covered Donald Trump during the 2016 presidential campaign, and now he reports from the White House and Capitol Hill. And this month, he began hosting a radio show. Before heading to Bloomberg, Kevin covered economic policy and politics for Politico and The Hill. Kevin also reported on the Penn State football coach Jerry Sandusky trial for Newsweek and The Daily Beast, which we will definitely want to talk about today. While at Penn State, Kevin won a Columbia Scholastic Press Association's Crown Circle Award as campus news editor of the school's Daily Collegian. Kevin Cirilli, welcome to Volta Insider.
Thank you for having me, my friend. Congratulations on your podcast.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So today we're going to talk about your career. Oh. And I wanted to start at the beginning.
Yes.
So did you always want to be a journalist?
No. I had no idea what I wanted to be. I grew up outside of Philadelphia in Delaware County, and I was always a news junkie. Like, I was always watching the news. But and I would always watch the Sunday shows with my mom and dad on Sunday morning. But I never really like understood that I could be a journalist. Like, it never really hit me.
Right.
And then when I got to Penn State, when I was a senior in high school, that was really during the 2008 presidential election, and I would cut class and go and hear like Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama.
That's
and
so
John
cool.
McCain. Yeah, and I would go to the back of the room where all of the reporters were, and I'd be like, "How did you get your job? That's the coolest thing ever." And they all looked exhausted and sleep deprived, and I'd be like, and they were like, "Why would you ever want this job?" But I really wanted to do it. I just thought it was so cool. So flash forward, when I finally got to Penn State, my dad was like, "You should try out for the school newspaper." And I did. And I walked in to the Daily Collegian, and I just felt like, as the second I stepped foot there, I was like, this is my tribe. Like, these people are awesome. They're like quirky, and they know everything that's going on campus. And I don't know. There was just an energy in that newsroom, and I was fortunate enough to make the cut. And then I covered student government, and then I covered crime, and then I was the campus news editor.
That's so cool. Yeah. And so you didn't study journalism. This was your extracurricular activity.
Yeah. So that's actually really funny, because I started getting recognized as being a student journalist in terms of sort of the college media landscape. And the College of Communications called me and was like, "You're technically not majoring in this." And so about halfway through college, I officially declared my major after I bumped around. I was like undecided. I got in for engineering.
Oh my God.
I wasn't my dad. I can't stand math. No idea why I did that. History at one point. But then I minored in poli sci and studied journalism. And for me, journalism was just like a ticket, like a free ticket to anything. And you kind of could just use it to meet whoever you wanted. And I just, I don't know, I really just latched onto it. It was so much more interesting than sitting in a classroom.
How did you manage all of that? It seems like a lot of work and a lot of confusion.
I don't know. I think that there are, like, for me, I think that I've just always sort of been that way. Like, even as a kid, I always was doing a million things. And I think, like, there's that quote by Albert Einstein, to keep your life is like a bicycle. To keep your balance, you have to keep moving. And so I've always kind of felt that if I don't have stuff to do, I get really bored and really antsy. But for me, journalism never, ever felt like work. Like, even now, like, interviewing people, it's not work. It's just not. I mean, so even back then when I was on the student newspaper, it was fun is the wrong word, but it never felt like work at all. So it just was, I think, like, I remember, like, professors just wouldn't understand that. Like, I wasn't the best journalism student. I didn't really like studying grammar or like learning all of that, the AP style book. That was never really my thing. My thing was, I love interviewing people, and I love a good story.
Spoken like a true storyteller.
Thank you.
You're at Penn State, and what was your first big story?
Crime. I was a crime reporter, but it really wasn't until the Jerry Sandusky trial that was my first monumental national story, and I was actually a senior getting ready to graduate when Sarah Ganim, who was a couple years older than me, broke and ultimately won a Pulitzer for this Penn State assistant football coach abusing boys, Jerry Sandusky. And it was just such a gripping story. And it was just the first time where I was in the eye of the storm. And my professor recommended me to Newsweek, and it kind of went from there, and I was a freelancer. And it just, seeing how the national media descended upon a small town and just totally uprooted this entire community, and just the themes of institutionalism, of abuse, of patriarchy, of crime, just everything kind of blown up in one microcosm. It was just a riveting, riveting story. But for me, what I will always remember is sitting in that courtroom and just watching the courage of those young people. At the time, they were my age, come forward and testify, forget about doing it in front of the global media. Literally, the global media was in that courtroom. But to have to relive that darkest part of their life in front of the man who did it to them, sitting right there, that is such a defiant courage. And it's something that I will never, ever forget as long as I live.
That's really amazing. How did you manage school during this trial? You know, you go and you cover all of these brave young people, and then you have to go to class the next morning. What was that like?
So the trial itself happened in the summer, but when the first reports came out, that was my final semester at Penn State. And I had no idea what I wanted. I mean, I knew I wanted to be a journalist, but I had no idea whether I wanted to go to law school or if I should be looking for internships. Should I be caring about my final exams? And for me, journalism, even then, was just this steady thing that just really helped me stay focused. As weird as that sounds, and as difficult as that is to kind of articulate, journalism for me starting in college was always the thing that helped keep me like focused, because if I had a story to tell and I was working on journalism, everything else just seemed to fall into place. Okay. So if I was covering that story, everything else sort of would fall into place. And it was during that trial, a week before, I was sitting in the parking lot in Delco, and I had just signed a freelance contract to cover the actual trial, and Politico called me, and I was literally sitting there in the Supercuts parking lot of Delco, and I got a job offer to work at Politico. And I said, listen, this is awesome, but I just really want to cover this trial. And Politico said, we totally understand. Like, you've covered this since the beginning. Finish the trial, and whatever, you will have 2 weeks from the conclusion of the trial, and that will be your start date. So Politico got it. They got my metabolism that to me, it didn't care where I was working. The biggest story at that time was the Jerry Sandusky trial, and there was no way anyone was going to tell me that I couldn't cover it.
I guess they liked that.
Yeah. And I think, it's a really great question, because I think I've always found the most success when I'm working for people who like that mentality, but I've always found not success when I'm working for people who don't understand that about me.
Okay.
I'm very driven.
Well, it helps that journalism is something that's very constant. There's always news.
There's always a story, especially these days.
Oh, true, true. And especially now, when the lines between print and television, radio, and digital reporting seem blurred, what advice would you give to someone wanting to break into journalism today?
It all comes down to the news. So it doesn't, you can, everything else, radio, television, print, social media, digital, all of that is mechanical. But if you can't talk to someone and connect with someone and interview them and get the story out of them, then who cares? Because you can package it any way you want. And there are a lot of people who get paid a lot of money to package things. But there will always be a market for getting the story and getting it right and telling it in an authentic way. And that, to me, is always, I don't care if I'm if it's a byline or on radio or television or on Twitter, I don't care. All I care about is that I get to be there to tell the story. Because I think you have to be confident in what you're good at. I really don't care about all that other stuff. I think I'm good at connecting to a story. That's what I love to do, at least. But if you want to break into journalism, you have to go after it. And you have to be relentless. And you have to say yes to everything. And you just can't stop. And journalism, you're not going to learn how to be a journalist in a classroom. You're going to learn how to be a journalist by doing journalism. And don't let anyone tell you otherwise.
And speaking of doing journalism, you covered the Trump campaign.
Yes. Dun, dun, dun.
The big year, 2016.
It was crazy. So this is actually a funny story.
How did you fall into that?
This is actually a really funny story. So two things. First and foremost, I covered the Jerry Sandusky trial and I have this inflated sense of ego, right? Because I'm like, oh my God, I just covered this. I'm knocking on doors in central Pennsylvania and trailer parks. You know, I'm to interview the families of victims. And I'm, you know, just this crazy, crazy ride and crashed down back to earth. And now I'm, you know, at Politico, which is a great organization. But I was very, very low on the totem pole. It was like intern and then Kevin. And rightfully so. They took a chance on me. And Donald Trump's Twitter got hacked. And my editor at the time said, you need to reach out to Donald Trump's people and get a comment because his Twitter has been hacked. And this was like, my God, 2012. This was when he was first starting to use Twitter. And his Twitter got hacked. Do you remember that song by Britney Spears and will.i.am Scream and Shout?
Yes.
His Twitter, Google this, because you will find a Kevin Cerulli story on this. His Twitter got hacked by Britney Spears lyrics. And I reached out to his lawyer, who was Michael Cohen. Was it the Cohen. Russians? No one knows who it was. But Michael Cohen was his lawyer. And I reached out, and Michael Cohen gave me a statement. And flash forward, and I put it in. I'm like, this is so stupid. Like, I don't really care about Donald Trump's Twitter. Who cares about that? This is 2012. Who cares about Britney Spears lyrics and Donald Trump's Twitter? And then flash forward to, I want to say, the summer of 2015, my best friend in the world, Quinn, and I, we were, he came to visit me in D.C., and it was the 4th of July, and he was like, you got to interview Donald Trump. And I was like, no. And he's like, you got to do it, man. Just do it. Like, that guy's crazy. Like, you got to do it. And he's my best friend in the world, but he doesn't give a crap about politics. So this thought was in my head at that time, like, I want to try and interview Donald Trump. And I went back into my email and I found Michael Cohen's comment from all those years earlier. And I called him up and he was like, oh, I remember you. You're the kid from the Britney Spears lyrics. And
the emails will save us all.
Or they'll kill us all. And he said, you have to meet Hope Hicks. And I'll connect you with her and we'll see if this interview happens. I was at the Hill newspaper at that time, and I convinced my boss to send me up to New York. I said, Bob Cusack, I said, Bob, if you let me go to New York, I'm telling you I'll come back with a Trump interview. And he's like, oh my God, okay, only you. So I went up and I met with Hope Hicks, and she said, come back a week later. And next thing I know, I was interviewing Donald Trump, and he threatened to run as a third party candidate.
Oh, boo-hoo for you.
And the rest is history.
So that was a big scoop for you. What was that like?
It was crazy because I woke up the next morning in my crappy little apartment in Arlington. And
your phone was on fire.
On fire. Like, blowing up Twitter. Like, you name it. Like, and I'm waking up and, like, my boss is, like, calling me, like, where the heck are you? Like, everyone wants to talk to you. Get into the office. And it was just, like, I don't know. It was like, the weirdest thing. But there were so many people in my life from where I came from who were intrigued by Donald Trump. And it was just, I just remember thinking that, like, where those people who are very important to me, contrasting them with this Washington world that I had found myself in, they weren't meshing. And that was just very, there was just, for me, that was the story, and I wanted to explore that. And I think looking back, that's what was really driving me to explore this whole thing, because then Bloomberg recruited me And my first day on the job, they said I was supposed to cover finance. And they said, you know, you're going to go to Florida and cover Ben Carson and Donald Trump until they fizzle out. And I just packed my bags and the rest was literally history.
Take us to the early days of the campaign trail covering Trump.
It was just fun. Like, and I know this is the other thing that I would say, like, if you're, I do not like to be pegged as a Republican or a Democrat, but I think you have to own when you're having fun in your job. And it was exciting. I mean, I was, here I was, like, this 26-year-old, just turned 26, and I'm essentially, the country becomes my office. And I remember the first rally I went to, he was speaking in one of the first rallies, Beaumont, Texas, which is truthfully the middle of nowhere. And he was speaking in this stadium, and I landed like this rural little airport, and this like reporter from China who barely speaks English is like, are you going to the Trump rally? And I can barely understand him. He barely knows English. And I'm like, get in the car, we're late. And we just speed. Like, I mean, like, I'm not the best driver. And we're like stepping on it, and we show up, and I just remember like this political rally, and I was eating popcorn because it was in a stadium, and there were stadium popcorn concessions and, like, you know, supersized sodas. It was like, it was unlike anything I had ever seen. And then all of a sudden, bam, it's gone. When he's gone, like, the town's gone. And I just remember thinking, like, this guy from The Apprentice, who I grew up watching with my dad, was giving these towns fun. He was just going in and just saying the craziest stuff. Contrast that with Jeb Bush, and who at that time was, you know, the anointed one. And I literally fell asleep during one of his rallies.
Oh,
and
my God.
And the AP reporter next to me was like, wake up, he's coming out. And I just, I don't know. It was just everything that everyone in Washington was telling me was not what I was seeing. And it was just fun. And then it took a turn to being really, really intense. And then I think when that happened, it was like, buckle up. This isn't a field trip. This is history.
When did it get intense? What part of the election cycle?
I think for me, it was in Tennessee. He started using the phrase, make America great again. And I remember my editor at the time kind of put it into context as to like what, there was just a lot of there was just a sense of intensity, and there were elements that suddenly were being talked about that were just the attacks, and his defense were, it was ratcheted up to a new level. Suddenly it wasn't just tweets. It was, I remember I saw a piece of graffiti. There wasn't really a turning point. I mean, I remember I saw graffiti in West Virginia that said, lock her up. And I took a picture of it because I was like, this is new. And then flash forward like a month later and everyone's chanting, lock her up. And then I remember Access Hollywood. That for me was just that being in Trump Tower that day and that level of intensity. And I have three older sisters. That was, it was just, it was intense. I don't really have anything other than that. I can report, but it's hard for me to really process. But it's easier for me to report on.
We met in Iowa.
Yes, that's right. Right before the Iowa caucus.
Right. And we were taking a bus ride to a Trump rally.
Yeah. What did you think of that?
I felt that the Trump rally was honestly a learning experience for me more than anything. I was very young during the 2012 and the 2008 presidential elections. And living in D.C., I actually didn't end up going to a lot of candidate rallies in other states, for example, like the kind of thing that we went to in Iowa. And so I just remember being really shell-shocked looking at everything. And on top of that, the fact that this is, you know, an unprecedented campaign, the campaign of Donald Trump.
Yeah, so it wasn't just you who felt that way. And that was, for me as a reporter, what was really hard was I was going to, like, 4 and 5 rallies a day sometimes, and in like 6 different states. And my editors didn't get, not just, no editors got it. This isn't a criticism of specific, but no one really, the people back in Washington didn't get it. And so it was, there was probably only like 12 of us who were really doing this. And it was like, you were trying to, you weren't fighting with people, but you were like, you've got to, people, like, you wanted to shake people and be like, go to a rally, because I would always say to people, go to a rally, because unless you go, you won't understand what is really happening. So for me, you know, I remember one time, I think you numb yourself to it because you're looking for news and you don't really, my job as a journalist is not to be the story, and I never want to be the story. And I would only do a podcast like this for a friend like Rachel.
Thank you. Because
it's really not my style. And there's enough 20-somethings who want to be the story that they don't need me to do it to. But I will say that I don't want to say you numb yourself to it, but you have a job to do. My commute into work every day was the protests outside of a Trump rally and the people. I mean, I have, even now, just saying that, I remember seeing someone spit on a woman. I remember eggs being thrown. I remember, like, things lit on fire. I mean, it was walking out of St. Louis. Someone said to me, I said, what are you make of this? And I said, are you here for Trump? And she said, no. She said, I'm here because finally the scab in our country is being picked off. And it just, there was just an intensity to it. But the media attacks, I think, for me, I remember this. This comes to mind just thinking about it. I went home. I would get like 2 days off of the trail to do my laundry. And just to kind of like, you know, I was paying for an apartment that I shouldn't have been paying for. But and CNN was on, and Wolf Blitzer was interviewing Kellyanne Conway. And it was so bizarre because he was pressing her to have Trump stop attacking the media. And that was like the first time where I was an objective observer. And hearing Wolf Blitzer, who I view as like a journalism god, that was the first time where I realized, like, holy shit, I'm in something that is a lot bigger than maybe I'm understanding.
After that realization, did anything ever happen? Has anybody ever said anything to you during your time at the campaign?
No, like, I think women in particular had it a lot worse, and so, you know, listen, we're not war correspondents, we're not solving the cure for cancer, we're not saving lives, we're journalists, and I think that for me, I always tried to, whenever I felt anxious about it, I would just try to be like, well, report this, like, what's really going on here? People are we're living in a time where people are very mistrusting of all institutions. Whether it's sports institutions like I saw at Jerry Sandusky, or religious institutions, or family institutions, higher education institutions, all of those mistrust and institutions that I covered in Sandusky were now magnified on the presidential scale. And people are very mistrusting of media institutions. And as a journalist, it's my job to, number one, earn people's trust, but also to kind of understand that I don't believe that Trump supporters are bad people. I'm an objective journalist. I don't vote in elections that I cover. I know a lot of Trump supporters. I think that I don't like when people call Trump supporters stupid, because there are a lot of people that I'm very close with who I don't think are stupid. But I also think that there are a lot of people who are very mistrusting of institutions as a whole.
You were with the Trump campaign election night. Tell us what that was like.
I was very sick. I had strep throat. I was so sick, and I was just like, I had tabs open on my computer about like going to grad school. I was going to take a 3-week vacation. I was like so good to go. I woke up, I want to say we were in Florida, and I just was so sick, and the plane bathroom was broken. Oh my God. It was just disgusting. It was just awful. The conditions were disgusting and gross. And I was so tired, so sick. And the Secret Service, once you were in the rally, they were like, you couldn't leave the building. And I just looked so ill. And the guy was like, let him go outside and get fresh air. And I'll never forget that, because I really needed a moment of like fresh air, because we had to do like a million rallies that day. And so that was like 24 hours before. And then finally we get to New York. I get finally some cough medicine. And we went to where Trump was voting with Melania and Ivanka. And there were all of these construction workers lined up outside of the elementary school where candidate Trump was voting. And I just remember thinking, if I'm super honest, two things. One, I just wasted a year and a half of my life. I felt that was honestly like what I felt. I was like, this guy is going to lose. What the hell am I doing with my life? I can't believe I've just given up like so much. I couldn't see the forest from the trees in that moment. And two, he kept saying this thing on the trail that drove me insane, because it was really a big reason as to why I felt like I was wasting my time, which was, if I lose, all of this is for nothing. This is all a waste of time. Like, direct quote. Like, I could hear him saying it. And I just remember being like, because everyone thought he was going to lose. He thought he was going to lose. His campaign manager right. thought he was going to lose. Paul Manafort thought he was going to lose. Everyone thought he was going to lose. And I was like, this is the last time in this school that you're ever going to see this billionaire who has been the backdrop to your mid-20s. He's never going to talk to you again. It's over. And he comes right up to me and he says, hey, Kevin. And I said, sir, I have a question. I have it on video. And I said, I have to ask you this. And I said, you keep saying that this is all a waste. And I said, do you really believe that? Like, I needed him to answer that. That was like a Kevin Cirilli question. And he said, well, I really want to win. And I walked out. We were on this like mini bus. It was the pool, as it's called. So there was probably like five to seven of us. And I just remember thinking, that's the last time I'm ever going to see Donald Trump. And
what was it like when he won? We've seen him since.
When he won, I remember thinking, holy shit, I'm a White House reporter. Yeah, that was it. And then you have to remember I had strep throat. Like, I was,
you can't.
So I was up all night, like chugging Red Bull and just like, and then the night after, and see, I knew that the morning after an election, if you're going to be a journalist, the morning after an election day is, you have to know that you're going to have to work really hard that morning, because that's when everyone wants to digest what happened the night before.
Right.
So that night, I finally went to the CVS. And I didn't have an apartment. I had nowhere to go. There was nowhere in D.C. Like, I literally had nowhere to go in Washington. So I remember, like, I went back to my apartment and I was so sick. And I could hear, like, these loud screams. And I knew they were protests. I just knew it. And I wrote in my journal that night, like, the pendulum is about it. Okay, now you're going to have the equal reaction on the left. And yeah, it was, I've never stopped, because it was, then it's the transition, and then the first 100 days, and then the first foreign trip, and then, you know, the reelect.
Do you think he'll be reelected?
I think he has a really good shot to be reelected. I think that I think as a journalist, I'm not a pundit. I never want to be a pundit. I never want to be a predictor.
Why?
Because I'm a journalist. And I think it goes back to, like, kind of why I got into this. I truthfully did not get into this to like opine or to hear myself talk. And I know it's kind of ironic because I'm telling you about my career. Like, there are a lot more interesting journalists than me. But I think, so I want to cover. I mean, if that is my assignment, I would want to cover that dynamic. But there's a lot of interesting stuff happening in the world.
You thought you were going to be a White House reporter or
yep.
White House correspondent. And instead now you're a Bloomberg anchor, radio show host, and you're still doing print and all of that as a Bloomberg anchor. So what has that been like?
Yeah, it's a lot. So I after the campaign, I transitioned from print into television and radio. And I think for me, I was anxious to try something new and to learn a new skill set. And, you know, it goes back to being a kid and just watching, my God, like Tim Russert and like all of the greats, Christiane Amanpour, like all of these amazing, Anderson Cooper, just watching them all. And so it was just crazy. I think that there in the industry, there's tension, but like print reporters always like poo-poo it. TV reporters and TV reporters always poo-poo at print reporters, and like kind of being able to understand both sides now, is it's been fun. I don't know. I think, But at the end of the day, it all comes back to like being a reporter, and whether you do it on TV or Twitter or on radio. I will say radio is hard because there's nothing like print is hard because every source is going to yell at your story. They don't like the headline. They don't like the words, blah, 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 blah. TV is hard because you have to be composed and like the look and just all of that. And there's a lot of people around, which can be when you're trying to go live with like Kim Jong-un running in front of you in Singapore, it's just like, okay, focus. Radio is hard because it's just you and just your voice. So if you stop talking, the show's over.
I know that.
But I will say like it goes back to being a journalist at Penn State. Like journalism is a team sport. And I love that. If you have the right people on the team, it's just fun. Not fun, but there's an energy to it. And there's still that energy. When you can find glimpses of that, that's like, you got to go with that because it's, I don't know. There's a lot of ways to make money in the world. And like, you might as well do it doing something that's fun.
And so do you get to choose what you write about? How does your position work? Or what
whatever
you
the news
on.
Is. So like nowadays, I don't know when this will be up, but you know, nowadays it's the partial government shutdown. So we're following every twist and turn of that. You know, of course there's every journalist, you know, Greta Van Susteren is, as you know, a very good friend, and she's always, it's been fun to watch her pursue her passion projects. Every journalist wants to, you know, do their, if they're print, they want to do their big long form magazine thing. If they're TV, they want to do their documentary. And there's always like those stories in the back of your mind that your passion projects that you want to do. But no, I mean, people deserve to know what's happening in Washington. Right now, it's the partial government shutdown.
What are you hearing from legislators about the shutdown?
Well, I'll put on my correspondent cap, Rachel. Lawmakers on Capitol Hill suggest that the president is really dug in on trying to get $5.6 billion for his wall, and that the deal that he circulated over the weekend is a non-starter. So 1 week until the State of the Union address, no one has any idea. Sad days in Washington.
Is what these legislators say to you behind the scenes the same as what they tell you on camera?
No. No. Let me tell you something. Every politician, this is the best one of the, I will never forget this. Some of the best advice I ever got. I must have been like 22. And this Democratic strategist took me out to lunch and for sushi. And he leaned across the sushi table and said, "Let me tell you something, kid. They're all assholes, even the ones you like." And I'll never forget it.
That's a really good story.
Good way to end.
Thank you so much, Kevin,
for being
on Volta Insider today.
Of course.
You've been a wonderful guest.
Yes. Well, I don't know if I'm a wonderful guest. There's a lot better guests you can book. Thank you for having me.
And yes, and be sure to check out Kevin on Bloomberg TV and follow him at Kev Cirilli on Twitter. For more information and other episodes, find us at voltainsider.com and follow us at Volta Insider on Twitter. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Rachel Greenberg, and this is Volta Insider. Special thanks to our podcast partners, Feature Story News, Head Ad Media, and our producer, Julie Donofrio.